And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of September 26th, 2020. Today, we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm hanging in there. It's been a week tinged with some sadness over the loss of a giant for gender equality, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Rest in power, as they have been saying for her, which I think is fitting. And so today in the podcast, we'll talk about how not only was she a giant for gender equality, but she also left a notable environmental legacy. And we will talk about some of the climate implications of her replacement on the Supreme Court, and even touch a little bit on rethinking the operation of our democracy. So tune in.
So, Mariah, this is a relatively sad time in our country. There's, of course, many things going on, but a milestone was passed. A great American became one with the ages. Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed on this past week, and it is a loss for America, right? There's a lot of eulogies for Ruth Bader Ginsburg out there right now, but it's almost lost in the noise of the politics around her passing. But she was a great American jurist and had huge impact on particularly gender equality, women's issues. I mean, she was not the first, but second or third Supreme
Woman. Second woman, yes. Sandra Day O'Connor was the first, and then Ruth Bader Ginsburg was the second Supreme Court, female Supreme Court justice. Yeah, it's truly a hero, certainly for me. I've seen the movies about her, and my family has all kinds of children's books about her. We even have a little Ruth Bader Ginsburg doll, which we took up to a mountaintop with a beautiful view and spread some rose petals to honor her memory. I shed tears over this. I mean, it's a really sad loss. She just was such a titan for fairness and for gender equality, as you say.
Right. Or to be all rolled into one person. It is an interesting question of how some people come to be kind of at the crux of history, right? That they just do the right thing all the time and they end up in this position. She probably didn't intend to become a Supreme Court justice and have this, you know, she would have asked for it if she wanted it, but I mean, not something you particularly work towards, but she ended up by doing the right thing in every instance at this, the fulcrum of history, right? I guess. I haven't seen the. Did she want to be on the Supreme Court?
Oh my goodness! She just wanted a job. She graduated top of her law school, and nobody would hire her because she was a woman. I think she ended up getting maybe like a clerk position or something. And the top of her law school, the top of the top law school, right? She was at Harvard and then ended up graduating from Columbia. So she just wanted a job. And then, of course, for a while, I think she taught at Rutgers. I'm pretty sure, and finally became a judge and just sort of worked her way through the system that way. So I'm sure at the beginning of her career, she never dreamed that she would herself wind up as a Supreme Court justice, but also in all of the ways that she would shape the world for women.
Yeah. So. Well, one of the ways that she, so we don't have time in our small podcast to go through all of the things that Ruth Bader Ginsburg participated in on the Supreme Court. But since we wanted to talk about climate, it's an interesting question to discuss her role in various environmental Supreme Court decisions where she was a champion for the environment. And it's something that is not, I think, played out particularly in a lot of the eulogies. They don't focus on the environmental aspect, but she was a very strong voice for environmental protection on the Supreme Court. I'm Mariah. She was there.
Right. I mean, the biggest right, of course, is probably the 2007's Massachusetts versus EPA, which was the she was one of the five justices who said that the Clean Air Act gives the EPA the authority to regulate greenhouse gases from automobile tailpipes. So basically saying, yes, carbon dioxide emissions, it's a pollutant that the Clean Air Act can cover, which of course has been the basis of so much legislation around fuel efficiency standards and all of these different ways that we've tried to curb greenhouse gases. And we have her to thank for that back in 2007.
And you can imagine how profound a decision it is if the question was whether or not carbon dioxide was actually a pollutant. And did anyone have legal authority to regulate it? And so it, to her credit, yeah, she was part of that. Let me just say in passing that the Mass versus EPA ruling had to do with the responsibility of the EPA under the Clean Air Act to regulate this pollutant carbon dioxide, which, but it, we should just note in passing that the Clean Air Act is 50 years old this week. It was passed in 1970. And I've got a link I'll put in the show notes that says that the Clean Air Act has saved roughly, you know, has had $2 trillion worth of benefits over the last 50 years.
And growing as it's being applied for climate change, right? Let's hope it has many, many, many more birthdays.
That's right. The Clean Air Act is the bedrock of climate action in the United States. And we'll come back to that. But I mean, it was passed 50 years ago. We haven't had any significant clean air climate legislation since then. But then it turns out in 2011, there was another case that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was involved in. And in that one, the name, just to be precise, was American Electric Power versus Connecticut. And without going into the details, because I don't know all the details, basically it was a question of whether or not the states could sue over pollution or whether it was reserved to the EPA. And Ginsburg was part of the ruling that said the states could not do it, but the EPA had to. And in a way, it sounds like a setback, but in fact, what it did was to strengthen the EPA's hand in addressing climate change issues. It made the EPA stronger. So again, she was in the right place at the right time. And those two acts, the 2007 and 2011 rulings, basically were the groundwork that Obama used to promulgate his clean power plan way back in the happy days when Obama was in office. And we can come back to that in a little bit. But there were a lot, many other rulings as well, right? I mean, so she was all over the place.
She was busy.
And in fact, I mean, it's just one of the ones we can touch on because it comes up in our continuing discussions that in April of this year, April of 2020, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was part of a decision that said that the EPA could regulate groundwater. And the reason that's important is because the Clean Water Act, the companion to the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act talks about navigable rivers and whatnot. And the idea that you could dump pollution into the groundwater and then have it make its way into a river, but you were not responsible because you didn't directly dump it into the river, was one of the things that was overturned in 2020, in April of this year. And of course, we're going to come back to that because there's some bad guys who want to change those rules again. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg was notorious for being an environmentalist, right?
Notorious RBG.
To coin a phrase. So Mariah, I guess, given the fact that she did so much during her tenure, the question is, what are the implications of her departure for rulings in front of the Supreme Court now, right? And that's a huge question because, well, everyone's getting beat up over the Supreme Court, and some people may have to pedal hard to catch up to exactly why it's so significant. But whoever they appoint to the Supreme Court is likely to be there for 30, 40 years making decisions.
I think some of the people they're looking at are 38 years old, right? That's some of the folks being considered. So you're talking about 60, right? I mean,
yeah. I mean, and as medicine continues, they'll be on a respirator hearing cases. Let me tell you a story about the Barack Obama Clean Power Plan. Okay. So because Ruth Bader Ginsburg participated in the Mass versus EPA, it forced that ruling said that the EPA had to, not could, but they had to regulate carbon pollution. So the Obama EPA went and took the Clean Air Act and found a way. They were stretching the rules. There was talk at the time. They were stretching the rules a little bit by not necessarily focusing on each individual smokestack, but looking at sort of the aggregate pollution in the state. Long and short of it, Obama proposed the Clean Power Plan way, way, way back in like 2014, 2015. So here's the way the dominoes fell was that it was proposed, the Clean Power Plan was proposed by Obama. Scott Pruitt, when he was Attorney General of Oklahoma, challenged it. Antonin challenged the Clean Power Plan to the Supreme Court. Antonin Scalia put a hold on the implementation of the Clean Power Plan and then literally died the next day or that weekend. Right? Oh. It's like Friday, he put a hold on Obama's Clean Power Plan, died the next day. And then, of course, from that comes all the Merrick Garland stuff. And, you know, this is how far back these things go. When Scott Pruitt got into to be head of the EPA, he put out something that I think is called the Affordable Power Plan to replace the Obama Clean Power Plan.
It was watery, right?
It was watery. It was just not as strong.
And the Green and Democratic-led states and Green groups basically sued to kind of throw it out, right?
You got it. So the Democrats, the blue attorneys general now sue, counter sue the other direction. And that case now is going to be in front of the Supreme Court. Okay. And it is going to be in a Ruth Bader Ginsburg-less Supreme Court with either 8 judges or 9 judges. But that Supreme Court will have to decide whether or not the Obama Clean Power Plan, which stretched the Clean Air Act a little bit, is constitutional. And if that future Supreme Court decides that the Obama Clean Power Plan was unconstitutional in its conception, that's a bad deal because it makes the next progressive president, makes it harder for that next progressive president to enact a Clean Power Plan, right?
Yeah, I mean, and not just that, right? The say the next president, say, you know, there is a switch in reign and Biden becomes the next president. Even if Biden has a Democratic Senate, a Democratic House that puts together really strong climate action, or Trump, whoever it is, puts together really strong climate action, it could hit the Supreme Court and they may shut a lot of it. You know, if there's suing issues of challenges to it, it might, those sort of things that are put forward by the administration would hit the Supreme Court and they may shut it down. So what would end up happening is the president that is trying to push through climate action with the Senate and the House is going to have to water down their climate action initiatives so that they can be sure that it'll go through the Supreme Court. So you're going to end up with, if you have a majority of conservative or I shouldn't say conservative, yeah. but a majority of judges on the Supreme Court who are not voting in favor of climate action, it will deeply cripple the president for making any sort of climate initiatives happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you're absolutely right. It makes it much more difficult to write rules that the Supreme Court would accept. And it goes so far as the following thing. It turns out, so the way the government works is that Congress passes a law and says, we want to clean air, right? It passes that law and gives the mandate to the Environmental Protection Agency to interpret the law and decide specifically in all these different little cases what it means to protect, to have a Clean Air Act, right? These guys on the Supreme Court don't like that. They don't like the fact that Congress is giving the EPA and other, the Federal Aviation Authority, I mean, all these other people who make regulations, they don't like the fact that the agencies get to make the regulations. And they want to insist that Congress pass a law with every single little detail in it as to what the EPA could do. And that is a mind-numbingly difficult thing to get through Congress. And again, it just, if these guys can stymie climate action, the Supreme Court, if they're unsympathetic, can find ways to stymie climate action. Well, there you go. So that is all the more reason why you ought to vote in the upcoming election and involve yourself in national politics. Learn about what's happening with the Supreme Court. Let me take us in a slightly happier direction, though, more hopeful and thoughtful. One of the sort of take home lessons for me of the passing of Ginsburg, and it's a lesson we keep learning over and over again, is how critically important one person on the Supreme Court can be, and how the loss of one justice changes the course of history. And that probably shouldn't be. We probably shouldn't be that fragile in our governing processes. And there is a guy named George Monbiot wrote an article, basically it was over in The Guardian. He's basically talking about England. But he was observing that there's a disconnect between voting, which citizens get to do. In England, it's once every 5 years. Here in the United States, it's once every 2 years you get to vote for somebody. Once every 4 years, you get to vote for president. And he says, that's fine. But in the interim, big interests, big special interests, we'll leave it at that. Big special interests can just pick up the phone with a checkbook, call their member of parliament or member of Congress and have things happen. And his argument is that money, capital, corporations, the Koch brothers are on the internet, and democracy is still in the 17th century writing on parchment paper. And that it is time for democracy to make the leap into the internet age and incorporate the internet platform as a way of doing business. I don't know. I mean, is that, would you smile at that?
Quill pens for a mouse, right?
That's right. That's right. I mean, it turns out there's some examples. I put up a link to an effort in Taiwan where you can talk about developing regulations. They had a bill that was about how Uber drivers could operate, and they essentially put it on this neutral platform where they had special mechanisms to avoid trolling and the sort of crazy responses that are demoralizing to people that want to participate. But they were able to accept input on the idea, and the system was able, the algorithms were able to put together people of like minds so they could talk to each other and formulate reasonable positions online. And it was a big success. And there's this transparency concept that you can do things online that we don't do now. And that there's no specific solution that I can offer about, do this and your democracy will be saved. But the idea that we should be incorporating transparency and speed of the internet into people's participation in democracy is one that seems pretty reasonable. Any sense?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think there's a lot of ways that our system could use a big overhaul. And I think one of the interesting quotes in this article that Monbiot wrote was, he says, like the suffragettes in the civil rights movement, it was excoriated for threatening our way of life, meaning doing things a little bit differently. And he said, almost all democratic advances everywhere have been secured by people who are branded as anarchists and criminals. And so, it kind of goes hand in hand with the idea that changing things up might seem crazy at first until it becomes commonplace and changes the world for in a more democratic direction. And so I think we're certainly at one of those inflection points where we might have to do something that's a little bit crazy, right? I mean, just in terms of needing to protect our democracy and to move us forward in a good way.
Isn't there a line from some song by the guy named Seal? When the world gets a little bit crazy,
you're never going to be a little crazy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. That'll have to be
our song. It's a good song.
Anyway, we should put it down there, Mariah. What we'll do is put up links to the stuff we talked about at the blog. Of course, if you have the time, you should go to the MCAN blog and try and read some of these things, because we can only touch on it. I mean, there's much deeper kind of discussion in the various articles that may pique your interest. So it's a good thing to do. If you have questions or have suggestions about what we ought to talk about, please send an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net, podcast@massclimateaction.net, and tell us what you think we ought to be talking about. We want to thank Diao Taka for his continuing research support. I want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of those things, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next 10 years under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.